Continuing on from yesterday's motivation that we generated before the first talk, we should try to consciously place our mind in the attitude, the purpose, to listen to and pay attention to the discussion on the Buddha's teachings on karma, so that we can understand from our personal perspective the meaning of the teachings on karma, and to put those teachings into practice as the foundation of following our path to enlightenment for the benefit of all others. Now, as I tried to establish yesterday, that the teachings on karma are, or were given, in order to enable us to generate a more realistic perception, or a more realistic attitude to our life, not only the way we live our life, but a new perspective on how to assess what's happening in life for ourselves and for those close to us, our family, friends, society in general, and the world. And this new perspective is an awareness that there is not just the external world of changing conditions, bringing about pleasant and unpleasant experiences. There is an interplay between the internal world of our own mind and the external world of causes and conditions that bring about happiness and unhappiness. Normally, we're not aware of the responsibility that exists in our own mind for what happens to us. So, by becoming more aware of this relationship, we can live our lives so much more skillfully. We can achieve goals which hitherto had been almost unattainable. We can realize that obstacles in life aren't like solid things out there which I can't break through. Because of the internal, the internal activity of our minds, although it's very difficult to change external things in life, we can change the internal attitude of our mind. And I think, in order to break through problems, right? I think one important point to be aware, we've already established that we have karmic potencies. There are constructive or virtuous potencies generated by constructive actions in the past, and non-virtuous potencies for unhappy experiences created by non-virtuous actions in the past. So we have all of these positive and negative potentials for happiness or unhappiness. That's sort of in the bank, you know. It's in our mind. Now, an important point is that whether a positive potency ripens or a negative potency ripens in terms of a pleasant or unpleasant experience, that depends upon our mental attitude, whether the general attitude is virtuous or non-virtuous. You see, if our mind is in a positive attitude of genuine, you know, loving kindness towards others, for example, when the mind is in that attitude, that is the soil which will germinate positive potencies. And if the mind is in a negative attitude, non-virtuous attitude, selfish, angry, jealous, proud, or whatever, that is the type of soil that will germinate a non-virtuous karmic potencies. So, superficially, the potencies are there, but they aren't our destiny. Life is not predestined by karma. There are so many changeable factors, and one which we have great potential control over is to consciously, through mindfulness, what am I thinking, why am I thinking of it, to mindfully establish our mind in a positive attitude. Mainly thinking of the welfare of others, not just me. And consciously abandoning negative attitudes, which is mainly self-importance or self-sensitivity. Me, what are they, what can I get out of it? What are they thinking about me? How does this impact upon me? So these worries, these concerns, if our mind is totally preoccupied with self-centeredness, almost certainly it's non-virtuous, because we're only thinking of number one and others are secondary. The general attitude of a virtuous mind is putting the welfare of others before our own. It doesn't mean total self-denial and making oneself a doormat for, you know, the greed and aggression of others. It is simply the way we relate to others. And there are many reasons for having a very fond outlook towards others. That's in the teachings on generating bodhicitta, which we began talking about on the Wednesday nights, and they'll continue next week, next Wednesday night, of how to generate, you know, genuine sense of warmth, kindness towards others. So that's the general way, by understanding karma, that we can consciously start to take control of our destiny, of our future. The imprints for future experience, the causes, are in our mind as dormant seeds. But we, through knowledge, we can take control over which ones will ripen and which ones cannot ripen. So, anyway, that is the important point to begin with in incorporating knowledge of karma into our daily life. The other thing is to reinforce our awareness of karma is that whatever happens, good experiences, bad experiences in life, we shouldn't just stay at a superficial level and indulge in the pleasure and have aversion to the pain. But we should stop a moment and think, right, this nice thing that's happening to me is dependent upon the outer situation, but also on the inner situation of positive karma ripening. This is the ripening of positive karma. So we think about it. And if a bad thing is happening, again, instead of having a knee-jerk reaction of aggression or depression, you know, self-pity, poor me, I think, okay, the outside circumstances, but that could not have happened without the inner cause of negative karma. So it means being more conscious of karma all the time. And not only for our own experiences, but family and friends and strangers. We read the news of good things happen, bad things happen to others. By being aware of karmic causality, it's wisdom. This is conventional wisdom. And it's reality. It's not a pretense or a cover-up to try and make people behave properly or to conform to the rules of society. The teaching on karma, if they were incorrect, then by checking up experiences, we could prove them incorrect. But if they're correct, the more we think about it, the more we observe situations, it will, the reality will become clear to us according to the degree of understanding we have. So yesterday afternoon we began the more conventional presentation of karma by talking about the 10 non-virtuous actions that which are naturally negative, that whether one follows a particular philosophy or not, all religions, all societies in general recognize the negativity of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, harsh speech, and so on. So in the detailed presentation of each of those 10 actions, that gives us a deeper idea of how karmic potencies are laid or created on our mind stream, born on the mind stream. And we mentioned in relationship to the karma of taking another sentient being's life or killing, there are the four main branches or aspects that when all four are complete, the complete karma is established. So there's the object of the action, there's the motivation behind the action itself, and the completion of the action. You know, the sentient being has died, which was my purpose, and we feel I've achieved my purpose. As I mentioned yesterday, if there's instantaneous sense of remorse, regret for having done that, then that completion branch is not there. There has to be a sense of I've achieved what I wanted. So even though the branch is not there, the actual karma of killing is not there. It's still negative action. You know, the object, the action, and the motivation were there. So there is negative karma accumulated, but not the specific karma of killing, which has specific results. And all karmas, where you have the four branches complete, then they have the potential to give rise to three main types of result. The first is called the throwing result or the rebirth result. So the rebirth result means rebirth within samsara. One of the realms of rebirth specifically, as we're talking about the negative karma of killing, that depending upon the severity of the action and the degree of hurt inflicted upon the person we've killed, their rebirth result can be rebirth in either the animal realm, hungry ghost realm, or the hell realm. Usually, from the karma of killing, it's rebirth in a hell experience. As I mentioned yesterday, there is not a hell realm out there waiting for us to go. Every individual who has a hell rebirth creates his or her personal hell after death. It arises as a result of their mind. But for them, it is still real. It is not just a dream. It's not just an hallucination. It is a period of time where one suffers incredibly self-inflicted suffering through, yes, hallucinated demons and so on, red-hot ground. But the weapons hurt. The red-hot ground burns. It is an actual experience for as long as the karma has the power to experience that. Eventually, that rebirth result will be exhausted. And so, as a result of karmas created in past lives, then one can experience death of a hell realm and be reborn anywhere else. It's not a definite succession, but it's up to the individual. Very difficult to generate a virtuous thought when you're experiencing the suffering of hells, but not impossible through past familiarity with generating virtuous thoughts. It's possible even to go from hell to a human rebirth or to a heaven, whatever. Or you can go anywhere according to one's individual karma. All right? Have you got any questions? Yeah, questions? When
bad things happen, is the negative karma returning, right?
A bad, what type of birth?
You see, when bad things happen,
bad thing.
Is bad karma?
Oh, yes, for us, yeah.
So, for example, someone scolds me, so that's my bad karma returning, right?
So that's one condition, yeah. Yeah.
So if I know that the other person is creating negative karma, if I keep letting the person scold me, that's not helping the other person, right? So then I should stop the other person from scolding me. Okay. But if I accept that it's my negative karma, I should just.
No, that's what I said. You don't become.
I also don't want to be a doormat.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. You don't become a doormat. So how do you avoid being a doormat?
How do I let the bad karma ripen without being a doormat, and also not to let the other person keep scolding, so the other person keep doing negative karma? So how does this?
Well, the bad karma has already ripened. This person is scolding you. It's ripened.
But it's keep coming.
Yeah, it's still coming. Okay.
So what should I do?
Okay, good. All right, that's the question. What do I do? Normally, how would we react?
I will scold the person back.
Yes.
But knowing that it will create more karma, so I keep quiet. But the other person thinks that I'm a doormat. So they keep scolding
yeah.
more. And then, because I don't want the other person to create, I need to help the other person
yeah.
to stop creating negative karma.
Yeah.
I wanted to say something so
yeah.
that the scolding will stop.
Yeah. Okay, we're getting there. If we scold back, does that stop them?
Sometimes if I win, yes.
Oh. Oh, good. But in general, they get more angry, don't they? And the argument gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's not a very skillful way to return an insult with a reciprocal insult. It just usually gets out of control. And if we do that, if we scold back with anger, yes, we're just creating the karma to be scolded in the future, more and more. So the key point is in the motivation behind our reaction. We have to react realizing that this person isn't 100% bad. Sure, they're angry at me, and that's negative karma they're creating. But the situation of them scolding me couldn't have happened if I had created the karma for it to happen. So in a way, I am responsible for this person to be creating negative karma against me. Because if I haven't created the cause to be scolded, they couldn't do it. Anyway, that's one thing to think about. But the main thing, we can use thinking like that so that we don't react with a negative mind, so that we react with wisdom and a skillful mind and a genuine warm heart towards the person who's scolding us. So then we have to use our wisdom. What type of reaction would be most skillful to help this person's mind? And that's up to us. You know, we know what they think, and so we choose a reaction. It can be a wrathful appearance and, you know, physical restraint. Maybe a slap on the face, but not coming from anger. Coming from genuine love and concern for the welfare of the person so that they don't create that negative karma. That's the key point. The knowledge of karma opens the pathway to a skillful response as opposed to an unskillful response. What type of skillful response? Well, so many possibilities. But there, in every situation, there are skillful methods. And so, during our life, we might think we have a skillful method, but it doesn't work. It makes them more angry. Okay, we blow it in that situation, but we did get angry ourselves. So we have a learning curve, and so we try another skillful response next time that might help. So this is how we live our life, incorporating the wisdom of karma, the knowledge of karma, into our skillful way of interrelating with others. And look, it's true that so many arguments, domestic arguments, arguments anywhere in society, arise out of misunderstanding. Misunderstanding, preconceived ideas about the other person, and so often when we get angry at somebody, we are actually projecting a fault upon them, which we exaggerate from our side. And so what we're actually angry at is not so much the actual person, but it is the person seen in a distorted, negative viewpoint by our own mind. So we're getting angry at our own projections. So when other people are angry towards us and they scold us, they're actually not scolding me, but they're scolding the person they think we are. And very often, we're accused of something. So, hey, I'm not that bad. I didn't do that, or that wasn't my intention. You know, so often mistaken ideas about what we intend, and that's what makes people angry. So, with this reasoning, we can understand the situation. The main point is to not react to aggression with aggression, and to react skillfully. Okay, so that's up to us. That's we have to go through learning experiences. Yeah.
So yesterday you said karma is certain.
Karma
is certain.
Yeah.
Certain. But how do we really know? Why can't it just be completely random?
The experiences that we have.
Yeah.
Why can't they be random? In the Buddhist teachings, something that happens has a cause, right? There's the cause and effect. Even on a totally, immaterial level, like physical, chemical activity. If you mix these two compounds, a reaction will occur and you get another compound. So there is a connection between the causes, the two compounds, and the reaction and the resulting compound. You can't get that resulting compound without the two causes being mixed. So there is a between the cause and the result, there is a similarity. And that goes for everything, not only the physical, chemical world, but for our own mind. For a result, a horrible experience, or a beautiful experience, that is a result. It cannot be random, because there has to be a cause for a happy experience or an unhappy experience. It doesn't just come out of the blue. It is a change in our state of mind, in our feelings of happiness, unhappiness. This change is not random. There has to be a prior cause which is similar to the result, the experience of happiness or unhappiness. That's why, that's in a simple way, that's the answer to your question. That's why there is no such thing as good luck or bad luck. In other words, causeless experiences. Like in New Year, people say, may you have good luck, good fortune. That's not enough. You still have to have the karma. It's like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, I think I mentioned this story, told me, I once asked him for six numbers underneath 45 for the lotto. And he said, sure, I can give. So he did gave me six numbers under 45, and I was really happy. Walking out the room, and just as about to leave the room, he looked up and he said, you also have to have the karma to win the lottery. So even the lottery is not luck. Or, I've thought about this, it might be chance that your numbers come up. But how many stories are there of people who win the lottery and then they're killed the very same day, or the money is stolen from them, and they wish it had never happened. So to experience the pleasure of spending that money, they didn't have the karma. Anyway, is that okay for now, for the answer to your question? That no random experiences can happen. There has to be a prior cause for an event to happen, and the prior cause has to have some similarity with the result. So in terms of karma, the prior cause for happiness is a benevolent karmic potency ripening in a virtuous mind, and the opposite for unhappiness. Okay? All right. Now, so we're talking about the results of the karma of killing. The rebirth result was rebirth in one of the three lower realms. The second is called the result similar to the cause, which has two aspects. There's the a karmic tendency to repeat that type of action, to have in a future life, say you'll be reborn as a human, even though the hell rebirth is finished, that original karma of killing isn't totally finished. There's the result similar to the cause. And so as a human, you might have a karmic or an instinctive tendency to kill. Also, within this result, there's results similar to the cause in terms of one's experience. One can have a short life, one can be killed or murdered during that life. And so that is part of the results similar to the cause of the past action of taking the lives of others. The third type of result is called the environmental result. So one can be born as human from another virtuous karma, but during that human life you can be born in a very dangerous place where there are natural disasters can take your life, like landslides, floods, or natural catastrophes. Or it could be in a zone of war where there's a lot of killing and threat to life. Or simply, you can be born in a place where you have an illness, but the necessary medicine is not available. And so, even though it's possible, if you had the medicine, you could be cured, you are born in a situation where the medicine is not there, and so you die. So that's called the environmental result. Now, for the other karmas, there's a similar pattern of explanation. The next karma is that of stealing, the next physical karma. So the definition of stealing is to deliberately take something of value which belongs to somebody else and which is not voluntarily given. So the object is another's possession, which you know they possess, is theirs, but you steal it and take it for your own. You consider it your own possession. So the degree of harm, of the strength of this karma, as with all the karmas, is equivalent to the degree of harm that you inflict upon the person. I mentioned the difference in the degree of heaviness of killing a mosquito compared to killing a human being. So with stealing a very small item is still the karma of stealing, but if it's of only a minor inconvenience to somebody, it's a much lighter karma than stealing something of great importance to them, which they need, etc. The motivation branch is, again, unmistaken recognition of the object. We have to clearly know what the object is that we're going to take. As in killing, if you kill somebody by mistake when you're meant to kill another person, it's not the full branch. Or similarly, if you have intention to steal one thing, but just take something else, it's not the full branch. Still negative action. There has to be the full intention to steal. Now, if we borrow a book, this often happens, and we forget to return it, then it's not stealing. We didn't intend to not return, we just forgot. But if one day we're looking through our library and we pick up a book, oh, I borrowed that from so-and-so years ago. They must have forgotten about it by now. I'll keep it. That then creates the karma of stealing is established with your decision, knowing that it belongs to somebody else, but deciding to keep it. Even though they lent it to you voluntarily, they expected you to return it. But you decided to keep it, so stealing. The third aspect of the motivation, as with all the others, is that one of the three poisons has to be involved. We can steal through desire, for example, you know, to possess an object, wealth or fame or whatever. Through anger, we can steal the possession of our enemy in order to harm our enemy. Through ignorance, we can have the mistaken belief that I am, everything belongs to me. Like in India, there are the different caste systems, and the highest caste is the Brahmin caste. And as the general belief system in India was that all beings emanated from Brahma, that everything belongs to Brahma. And if you belong to the higher caste of Brahma, then everything is yours. And this was at the time of Buddha. And so there are these arrogant Brahmins who could go to the marketplace and just take what they wanted without paying for it through that belief. That was an ignorant belief. That was not true. So, through ignorance, you meant no harm to the person you stole from, but you harmed them through your ignorant belief. So that's an example. The action of stealing is fairly clear. We can steal by stealth or by force or by cheating. You know, we're a merchant and we use different weights, improper weights and so on. Or we can ask somebody else to steal for us, and then we receive the stolen goods. The completion of the action of stealing is when we consider the stolen object to be yours or to be mine. So this karma of stealing, as we mentioned, in the realms of rebirth, it doesn't occur in the hells, because in the hells there is no article of enjoyment possessed, so there's nothing to steal from anybody else. It's absent. I mentioned the different types of human being, the humans of the northern continent. There can be no stealing because nothing is possessed, nothing is considered to be mine. For the humans in that particular situation, everything is shared equally and truly viewed as common property. But that karma of stealing could occur at any other level of the desire realm. I remember when I did my 3-year retreat in Australia on an island called Kangaroo Island. So as you can imagine, lots of kangaroos on that island. And so I saw no humans, but I had a nice relationship with the kangaroos. And I used to watch this mother kangaroo. She brought up two young ones during the time I was there. There were so many games would be played between the mother and the baby kangaroo. And at one time, the mother, I watched her, and I would give them grass from the garden. So the baby was eating grass, and the mother went down and pulled the grass out of the baby's mouth, sort of held it up, and the baby kangaroo tried to get it. She lifted her mouth higher and higher so that the little kangaroo started to climb up her neck to get at the grass, but she kept holding it higher and higher. So it was just a game that she was playing. But it's like animals can steal, you know, like in that sort of context. The types of result, again, there's a rebirth result, which is rebirth in one of the three lower realms, either animal, hungry ghost, or a hell realm, according to the severity of harm inflicted upon the person one steals from. The results out of the cause that in a future human life one will have a karmic tendency to steal, and in terms of experience we will lack objects of enjoyment, or our own possessions will be stolen from us. The environmental result is said to be that our possessions can be destroyed by natural conditions, such as if we're a farmer, a hailstorm can destroy our crop, and things like that. The third, physical non-virtue, is called sexual misconduct. So sexual misconduct, in general, the meaning is to cause harm to another person through indulging in sexual relations. There's a list of different situations of how sexual misconduct can occur in terms of the object. The points are, first of all, an unsuitable subject. So this is probably a very, well, I know it's not that common, but an unwilling person, like rape, is clearly sexual misconduct, causing hurt and harm to the direct person, or indirectly through taking if they're a couple, have a relationship, whether they're officially married or whether they're just, but they do have a committed relationship. So if we have an affair with one of them, even if they're completely willing, but we cause harm to their partner, to their mind, we break up the relationship. So that is sexual misconduct. Or with somebody who's under the guardianship of another, and whose guardian is supposed to be looking after them, and we cause a break between that relationship of protection between the guardian and the person is sexual misconduct. A close relative, with oneself, with a person of our own gender or our own sex, or with an animal. All of these in the Abhidhamma are said to be under the umbrella of sexual misconduct. But the main reason in the Abhidhamma text is that there are a lot of situations where we're not causing harm to another, but the Abhidhamma says the reason it is under the label of sexual misconduct is because there is excessive desire. In terms of homosexuality, there is excessive desire, not just for beings of an opposite sex, but of those of our own sex. So it's not exceedingly heavy, but there's this element of excessive desire, and that's why it's included under the umbrella of sexual misconduct. So as you see in the list, there are not only unsuitable subject, but unsuitable organs, such as the mouth or the anus, unsuitable place, such as in the open, where others, you know, in the view of others, or in a holy place, near a stupa or a temple, an unsuitable time. Again, it could be with one's own wife, but she's pregnant, or nursing. And this is said to be under the umbrella of just excessive desire. or with somebody who's living within a vow of celibacy. So, in the notes, as explained there, unsuitable times include whether either partner has an illness which will be aggravated by sexual behavior, or if we have a contagious disease, which, and we know that it's possible that we can infect the other person, but we don't care. We still engage in sexual activity. And they can be, of course, totally willing, but in our mind, we don't take any precaution to prevent them being infected by what we have. So there's a whole spectrum there of situations related to the karma of sexual misconduct. Some are relatively innocuous, and the participating couple can be totally voluntarily engaging in that behavior. But the underlying problem, according to the Abhidhamma, is excessive desire. So the motivation for the action is unmistaken recognition of the object. If our partner leads us to believe that they're not related to any, they're not married, or that they don't have an established relationship with somebody else, and so we don't know that, then we don't create the sexual misconduct of adultery. There has to be full intention to engage in the action. So if one individual is raped by a married person, for example, then of course the individual does not create the sexual misconduct of adultery. One of the three poisons has to be involved of desire, anger, or ignorance. Through desire, it's fairly obvious. Through anger and aggression, it's fairly obvious. Or through ignorance, it's just describing to the view, this is in the Abhidhamma text, that like men can have the opinion that a woman is like ripe fruit, there for the picking and eating. Sort of a very self-centered attitude, but which is mistaken, is not true. The completion of the act is to experience the pleasure of the of orgasm. The occurrence, again, this is all coming from the Abhidhamma, the sexual misconduct doesn't occur in the hells because no sexual partners are possessed in the hells. It doesn't occur in the northern continent. And in the Abhidhamma explains that if a couple, a man and a woman, wish to have intercourse, then they go hand in hand to a particular type of tree. And if they, when they go underneath the branches of the tree, if the branches come down and cover them, then they can engage in sexual contact. If the branches don't come down, then they shake hands and go their different directions. It's an interesting place, the northern continent. But it can occur at all the other levels of the desire realm. The throwing salt of birth in one of the three lower realms is an animal, having a ghost or a hell being, similar to the cause. In a future human rebirth, one will have a karmic tendency to engage in sexual misconduct. And in terms of one's experience, one's partner may be hostile or unfaithful to us. The environmental result is that one will be born in a very unpleasant, dirty, ugly environment. So those are the three non-virtues of a body. Then the next are the four natural negativities of speech. First of which is lying. So to lie is to meaningfully distort the understanding of another. The object, clearly, is somebody other than oneself who can understand the meaning of one's words. So, in terms of the motivation, there's unmistaken recognition of the person we want to deceive. There has to be full intention to lie. So, to lie, we must know something which is correct and deliberately deceive somebody by telling them the opposite. So, you know, if we believe something to be true, but it's not true, but we think it is, and we tell the other one and try to say, look, this is how it is. Well, they get the wrong idea, but that's not lying. We have to consciously be deceptive and get them to believe something which is wrong. The third is one of the three poisons. So clearly we can lie out of attachment and anger. Many situations we can do that. Lying out of ignorance is examples are that this is in the Abhidhamma. We can have the attitude that all is fair in matters of love, which means you can lie to somebody in order to gain, establish a loving relationship. This happens. We tell untruths, we deceive others' minds, because our whole purpose is to establish a relationship with somebody. So believing that there's nothing wrong in lying in this situation, that's lying out of ignorance. The action of lying can be either verbally or just by some gesture, some physical gesture, we can deceive somebody into thinking something the opposite. And the completion of the act is when the person understands and believes our lie, and so their mind is deceived. The heaviest lie is to deceive others into thinking that we have spiritual realizations. And that's so heavy, because people develop trust and faith in us, and their hope for their future happiness is invested in us, but we misguide them. And so we can cause them to lose faith. We say, I have clairvoyance, and we tell people to do this, but we're lying in order to deceive them. And so when they see that we're lying, they'll give up Buddhism or Christianity or whatever religion we might represent. So it's very heavy to pretend we have spiritual realizations. Lying doesn't occur in the hells. There's no purpose to lie in the hells. It doesn't occur in the northern continent, but it does occur at other levels in the desire realm. The three results, again, the throwing result, rebirth in one of the three lower realms, according to the heaviness of the harm we cause others. Results in the cause, we have a karmic tendency to be deceptive, to tell lies. And result, similar to the cause in terms of our experience, is that nobody will have trust in what we say. Even we saying truth, people won't believe us, and others will spread false stories about us. The environmental result is said that we've been in a place which smells, born in a place which smells badly. People will be corrupt, and they will steal from us and cheat us. The next is divisive speech or slander. So the meaning of slander is speaking with the intention, the distorted intention, to alienate two friends or a group of friends, or to increase disharmony or discord between people who are already enemies, to further them, the distance between them. So the object branch of slander can be either a harmonious group of people or a group of enemies among whom we intend to prevent reconciliation. So when we're attached to someone and another is friendly with them, then we feel jealous about this other person making a friendship with our friend. And so we abuse that other person through jealousy. Or we consciously say bad things about the person to our friend so that our friend dislikes the third person who is making a friendship with them. If we check up, we do this a lot in everyday relationships. We do discriminate between people we like, people we dislike, and people we ignore. And so we don't want people we dislike to join our circle of friends. So we broadcast, we say bad things about them, directly to them, or to our friends. So a friend, oh, really? Is he or she that bad? Oh, I won't communicate with them. But our whole purpose has been through attachment to our own friends. So the motivation, clear, again, unmistakable recognition of the object, the full intention to separate friends or to prevent reconciliation. Sometimes we can say something which is true, but without the intention to cause a division. But what we say, as a result of what we say, we break up a relationship. It was true, but that wasn't our intention, that this couple will break up their relationship, but it happens. So, as it wasn't our intention, it's not slander. With slander, you've got to have the intention to break a relationship. So, we have to be skillful, because often people ask our advice. Oh, I like so-and-so, what do you think? Or, I'm having a terrible relationship with my partner, should I leave them? I mean, these questions come. So, we have to be really on our guard. It might well be the right advice to break that relationship. But we have to do it with a good heart so that both parties are not hurt from our side, what we say, what we do. And very often, where there's disharmony in a relationship, which happens in just about every relationship, as I said before, the disharmony is because the couple are arguing, but what they're arguing about is their projected hopes and idea of the other person, and the other person is not fulfilling the image which their partner wants them to fulfill. And the same thing is happening in reverse. Each member of the relationship is exaggerating the person to whom they're related in an unrealistic manner. And it's impossible, actually, to live up to the projections put upon us by our friends, by our partner. So there is disappointment. But we blame the other person for not living up to our projections. We had exaggerated our view of them into an impossible, in an impossible way. And when they let us down, we see the fault from their side. It's coming from their side. It's not. We don't see that the actual fault is coming from our side, that they cannot possibly live up to our projections and expectations. So we criticize them. As we know, relationships are they're minefields, aren't they? There are certain topics of discussion which you avoid because there's disagreement. And so it can get worse and worse, or it can be at an almost intolerable level. Like I remember when I was a student, a friend of mine, his mother and father lived in the same house, but the refrigerator had his food and her food on each side of the refrigerator compartment. That was an illustration of how much they communicated, which was virtually zero, even though they shared the same house. And I remember thinking, oh, what a tragedy. And I knew this, my friend's mother, who was an incredible woman, so kind, generous. Also, she owned a very nice house by the beach where we could go for holidays and just get the key. I didn't know his father so much, I had met him. So when people come to us and say, well, what do you think? Should I leave him or her? Or difficult. Difficult. But with a good heart, we can help. It doesn't have to separate. We can say, look, you're expecting so much. You want this from them. They can't fulfill your expectations. But they got their own life, their own situations. And maybe you're asking too much. And actually, I think many relationship problems can be resolved with a third party just spreading a bit of reality, a bit of light upon the situation. But as you know, it's such a common problem, and probably the worst problem in human society is the inability to maintain a friendly relationship. Certainly in Australian society it is. Very, very hard. Okay. So the other branches, the completion of the action of a slander is that the other people understand what we say and a division occurs between them. Slander doesn't occur in the hells, because in the hells people perpetually hate each other. There are no friendships in hell. It doesn't occur in the northern continent, but it does occur elsewhere in the desire realm. The throwing result results similar to the cause, as you can imagine, similar to the others. We can have the karmic tendency to slander, and in terms of our own experience, then we're going to have great difficulty in establishing permanent friendships. As a human being, we'll be very lonely, people won't stay with us, and so on. The environmental result is said to be in a very difficult environment, very rocky, uncomfortable place, steep cliffs, and so on. So that's slander. Then harsh, abusive speech. So the meaning of harsh, abusive speech is through an afflicted mind, through ignorance, anger, or hatred, we speak harshly, words that are understood by another. This includes sarcasm, insults, ridicule, and swearing. It can even include just making a facial expression with intention to hurt somebody. So it doesn't necessarily have to be verbal, but you know, physical. So with harsh speech, whether our words are true or false, it can still be harsh speech. Like, we have to be careful. There is something about a person which is true, but if we speak it with the thought to hurt them, or just mention it, then they can be hurt. The example given in the Abhidhamma is, you know, for example, somebody's in a wheelchair, but and we just call them a cripple, you know, in a harsh way, with the intention to hurt them. They are crippled, but by saying, oh, you're just a useless cripple, that really, really hurts. That's harsh speech. Or if somebody, their habits are fairly dirty, and we call them a pig, okay, they may be very dirty and behaving not unlike a pig, but it's harsh speech, because we meant to hurt them. Verbal abuse is the most common way in which we express our anger, and it can be so quick. So quick. I mean, it's good to watch children interacting amongst each other, whereas, you know, one says something bad, the other says, oh, they double it. And then the other bird triples it, and you know, the insults. But this comes so quick. So the object of harsh speech is any sentient being who can be hurt by our words, or even an inanimate object, you know, such as a thorn that we tread on. We can swear at the thorn. It's, of course, the thorn doesn't understand, but it's still, that swearing is harsh speech. Particularly heavy harsh speech is towards those who have strong karmic affinity with, like our parents. To speak harshly to our parents is very heavy negative karma, or to our spiritual teachers. So, it's not uncommon for teenagers, poor old teenagers, they get a lot of criticism, but for teenagers to be angry towards their parents and to speak harshly towards their parents, but it's such heavy karma. So, because of familiarity, it's very easy for family members to push our buttons, isn't it? We can so quickly, there goes mum or dad again, don't say that, you know. And we get angry. They can easily get under our skin, and because we harbour resentments, we resent close friends and family members for past things they've done, they can build up. This resentment is a type of anger. It's building up, and it can easily explode. So we really have to watch our mind in terms of harsh speech. So the motivation has an unmistakable recognition of the object. If we mistake somebody at a distance to be our enemy and we shout abuse at them, then, although it's negative karma, the branch is incomplete because that wasn't the person. That wasn't the person we intended to abuse. There has to be the full intention to abuse, speak harshly. Sometimes we can say things which people can take as abuse, but that wasn't our intention. We didn't mean to hurt them through our words, so the karma's not there. Easily you can think of how we can go indulge in harsh speech through desire, anger, or ignorance. The action is saying the words that are understood, and the completion is that the person understands our words and is hurt by them. and we are satisfied that we've hurt them. That was our intention. Harsh speech does occur in the hells, where beings are constantly abusing each other. It's absent from the northern continent, but occurs elsewhere in the desire realm. And the three types of result, as before, rebirth in one of the three lower realms, are similar to the cause. We habitually abuse people when we're born as a human, or we're criticized and abused by others. The environmental result is said to be born in a barren and dry place, many thorns, rocks, broken glass, snakes, scorpions, and evil people. That description reminds me of the area in Australia where Lama Zogu Rinpoche told me to build the monastery, the Australian monastery. Very barren, dry, rocky place with many snakes, scorpions. Was there. But that was 20 years ago, and I've been putting a lot of effort into making gardens and pools and fountains. It looks much better now. But that's exactly what it looked like. And I remember saying to Lama Zogu Rinpoche, why Bendigo? And there's so many other beautiful places in Australia. And his answer was, because it's there. Somebody had offered the land. And actually, over the 20, well, nearly 30 years since the land was offered, it has been transformed. And it's looking more like a pure land every day. Okay, idle gossip. So, idle gossip is the next one. And this is... idle gossip is the least heavy verbal negative karma, but because we engage in it so often, it gets heavier, it becomes habitual and more heavy. So it includes different types of speech. There's perverse speech, which is, example, incanting black magic or diabolically praying for terrible things to happen. Or it can be talking about ordinary things which are none of our business, such as repeating gossip. Often we hear a bit of gossip and we just can't wait telephone somebody or see them or send a text message. Oh, do you know what about so-and-so? So, we there may not be the intention to hurt somebody, but we just feel that, oh, I've got a real treasure here and I've got to share this with somebody else, this gossip. Gossip can also be talking about things which are true, even talking about the Dharma, but explaining it to those who aren't ready to understand or have no respect or no interest. Often, you know, we can get on our soapbox and proselytize our religion, our belief. And so what we're saying is true, but hey, this isn't the situation to talk. They're not interested. In fact, they're going to reject us and resent it. So, it's said to be idle gossip to do that sort of activity, even trying to talk Dharma in a situation where it's useless. There's a list of seven other types of idle gossip. Bickering, speaking behind somebody's back, being argumentative or provocative in your speech. You know, deliberately trying to provoke a bit of emotion or anger. Or reciting religious liturgies for our own, for no particular reason, or repeating political or commercial slogans. And there's just complaining, moaning and grumbling is idle gossip. Or joking, being silly, humming, sighing, whistling, for no good reason. So we really have to watch what's coming out of our mouth. Or telling stories and gossiping about political leaders, celebrities, politics, war, crime, when there's no way that we can improve the situation and we're just being a busybody. And this, I mean, this sort of gossip, talking about, you know, sport or politics, and we know that the, you know, the magazines which and the news agencies which publish so about the royal family, this, that, it's a, you know, $1 billion enterprise because people buy it. They want, but that's just idle gossip. We can't help. If we can be, if our discussion can help the political situation, okay. But most often, it's not. It's just gossip. Another one, speaking like a drunk person or a mad person or talking nonsense, just in a stupid way, without any purpose to help others. Yes, we can act and say ridiculous things when there is behind it the intention to help somebody else understand what's going on. That, of course, that's valid. And then speech, you know, flattering somebody because we want to get something from them, or pressuring them, or bullying them, or threatening them, or bribing them, or through boasting, in order to get something that we want, you know, when we use our speech in those situations. So the object of idle gossip is something with no meaning, significance, or importance that we treat as if it were so. So the three parts of the motivation are there. The action is saying the words or doing the particular action of whistling and so on. The worst type of idle gossip is to disturb a person who's trying to meditate, or who intends to meditate, but you distract them. It doesn't have to be formally sitting, but somebody can be circumambulating a stupa. And, you know, this practice of circumambulating Buddha images and stupas is incredibly worthwhile. But it's not just the physical. Physically, okay, there's benefit physically. Mentally, if one mentally is conscious of why we're circumambulating, maybe reciting a mantra, or just thinking of the qualities of the three jewels which the stupa represents and circumambulating, then so that the mental activity is actually more important than the physical activity of circumambulating. But if somebody's doing it, and we come, oh, do you know what happened about such and such? And we say some gossip, that distracts them. That's the worst type of idle gossip. And you can see why. Because it really distracts them. And I know, this is my personal experience. One time, long time ago, I was at Bodh Gaya. A lot of Lama Yeshe Lama Zopa students were at Bodh Gaya. What we call the Dharma celebration. Bodh Gaya is the holiest stupa of all. And so there are 85 monks and nuns of Lama Yeshe Lama Zopa, all Westerners. And so we all had dormitories and so on. And there's one German monk who, he was senior to me, in terms of duration of ordination. I knew he was obsessed with sport. And at that time, there was a world boxing tournament. I think it was Cassius Clay and, I don't know if you're aware of Cassius Clay, the boxer. At his peak, he was very, everybody was thinking about him. Anyway, the tournament happened and I think Clay won the bout. And I happened to hear it on the radio. I was at the dormitory. So I went up to the stoop and circumambulated. I saw the German monk and I knew that he would really want to hear this. But I So I committed the karma of idle gossip, of saying, hey, you know who won the bout? And interestingly, after I left the stupa that night, it was late at night, and I was walking back along the road to the hostel where we were all accommodated, there was a university further up the road, so these young Indian students on their bicycles. And I was sort of walking, thinking I was very holy and good, having circumambulated the stupa. Rode up close behind me, and from behind there were two on the bicycle, one riding, the other was just a passenger. So he just clipped me over the back of the head and kept riding. And I immediately thought, oh yeah, that is the karmic result of idle gossip at the Bodh Gaya stupa. I also confess, I did immediately look around for a rock to throw at him. But I restrained myself from doing such a thing. And I generally, that was, there can be instantaneous karma. Usually when we talk about karmic results, it occurs in the next life or some future life, but there can be instantaneous result. And I thought, hit on the head by gossiping about boxing, I made the connection. And I tried to apply the opponent powers as strongly as I could. So, So the completion of the act of idle gossip is expressing the words and distracting somebody. The results, as you can comprehend, rebirth in one of the lower realms, results similar to the cause, is what we habitually will gossip. In terms of our experience, there will be no power in our words, even if we try to speak truthfully or clearly. People don't listen to us. The environmental result, we're born in a place where the seasons occur out of balance. Trees might flower and fruit at the wrong time, or we'll be in a very overcrowded, busy place. So that completes the four non-virtues of speech. And after lunch, we'll talk about the three non-virtues of mind. So, the physical and verbal non-virtues or negative karmas, these come from mind. That we don't do anything physically or verbally without a mental intention leading to the act. So, when we talk about the non-virtuous karmas of mind, of covetousness, of malice and wrong views, there isn't a chorus. They lead up to one of the seven physical or verbal non-virtues. They precede those actions. But just leading up to it is a mental karmic path as well. And we create karma just by generating the strong, say, covetousness, the strong desire that leads us up to the mental desire leading up to the point of, say, stealing, then already we've created a negative karma of mind by developing our mind to the point of intending to steal. And then when we steal, we create the physical negative karma as well as the mental negative karma. Okay, so we'll come back together after lunch and we'll talk about those mental non-virtues.